The good, the bad, and the alternative. By Madame Melon Meow and Sarcastic Celery. Read by Sam Gabriel. Based on the works of Andrew Hussey. Chapter 7. The Fear Keeps Me Moving. Tavros. From up here, Tavros could see the full sprawl of the city. It was awesome and terrible in the truest sense of the words. Horizon to horizon, roads of black stone, buildings that touched the clouds, humans moving through and along their structures like ants. A persistent glow radiated from around it all, lights that did not burn, permeating the world with their hum. He really had been gone a long time. Even at the little vampire's castle, there was nothing comparable to this scale of invention. Unless the castle had been purposefully anachronistic or something. He sank in the air with a downdraft and fluttered his wings to regain the altitude. No way was the wind going to bring him back down to that explosion of horrible canines. It was Tavros's senses that first picked up the subtle shift of everything's gravity. An infinitesimal degree of lightness everything in the area experienced, the magic warming up the space around them to account for a sudden appearance of mass. Then, as soon as the dogs appeared, Tavros made a brave, daring escape through the nearest window. The world blurred around him as he disappeared into a nearby copse of trees, and then, not trusting mere concealment, he took flight. Thankfully, he hadn't accidentally flown miles away as he might have in Faerie, where distance was a tenuous proposition at the best of times. Instead, he could still see the house and all the beasts covering its lawn from a traversable distance. He saw a brightly colored vulture as well, circling about the house with something in its talons. Strangely, it dove towards the house and didn't come back up. The dogs still didn't look like they were going anywhere anytime soon. Tavros sighed. He lowered himself down to a treetop and got ready to wait. It wasn't long before someone came to get him, or maybe it was long, it was hard to say. Ever since the last time he was in the mortal realm, it was hard for him to gauge time. Sometimes he'd even lose it entirely. The sun was still up, at least, when Tavros spotted that peculiar vulture soaring through the air towards him. It alighted on a branch right next to him and made a groaning honk noise, looking at him with strangely intelligent eyes. With a terrifying puff of feathers, the vulture's head exploded, startling Tavros nearly off the branch. When the fluff drifted away, a familiar face was looking at him, sprouting precariously from the vulture's body. "Motherfucker!" Tavros exclaimed. He'd picked up the phrase from this friend of his. "Motherfucker yourself, my man, motherfucker, what the fuck are you doing here?" The vulture body, still normal vulture-sized, reached out a wing as though to go for some kind of greeting that involved human hands. The exchange that followed looked something like Tavros persistently reaching for a cookie jar and being reprimanded by the vulture wing. Tavros had no idea why they were doing this. It wasn't like there was a precedent to them greeting each other physically, but it felt right. "I knew we'd be tight as a motherfucker as soon as we motherfucking hit it, my brother. Fuck yeah!" Gamzee laughed. He wrapped his wings around Tavros in a bird hug. "Where the fuck you been, man?" he whispered intensely into Tavros's ear. When they pulled apart, he saw Gamzee looking at him with a sad expression. "The fucking mirror just up and shattered some years ago for no motherfucking reason. You got any clue what happened, brother?" he asked. Tavros felt guilt churn in his stomach. This was not how he wanted his day to go. He was obviously over the moon about seeing Gamzee again. The tears he felt welling up was proof enough of that, but the mirror... I didn't know I'd ever see you again. I can't remember what happened all too well with the mirror." It stung his tongue like iron. Fairies could speak half-truths, but their soul knew what a lie of omission was regardless of technicalities. He swallowed roughly and tasted blood. "Well, fuck, man, I'm just glad you made your way up here. We got a whole new motherfucking generation since we last shot this shit." Gamzee produced a card from somewhere in his vulture form and held it out between feathers. It was a Pokemon card, featuring a mon he'd never seen before. Some kind of two-legged fox-like creature colored blue, black, and tan, with spikes protruding from its hands and chest. It was a fighting type, which Gamzee knew was Tavros's favorite, and steel, which meant a lot of resistances. Tavros's eyes bugged, and he grabbed the card with two hands. "By the Queen, when did this come out? What's the generation called?" he asked, momentarily forgetting his deception. Gamzee chuckled. "07, brother. About a year over here after the mirror broke. The gent's called Diamond Pearl." The shapeshifter smiled. The fairy squinted his eyes. For whatever reason, Pokemon had made its way to the Feylands and sort of spiraled out of control. Practically every creature was trading the cards, even some of the trees, and it was becoming less and less uncommon to see a fairy holding a Game Boy, even though the technology was punishable by death according to the courts.
"Diamond and Pearl doesn't count," Tavros said.
"I think it counts by many, at least motherfucking half," Gamzee responded.
"Nah, you said diamond and quartz, that doesn't count," Tavros said.
"Don't get all motherfucking rules technical on me, my most valacious fucking fairy," Gamzee responded. "It was a better fucking guess than salt and pepper."
"They're gonna add food Pokemon, you're gonna see," Tavros defended his prediction.
"Brother, you gotta meet some of my other motherfucking friends. They're gonna love you," Gamzee said optimistically.
"Ha ha, yeah, man," Tavros replied unconvincingly.
He wondered if he'd run into anyone else he would need to keep a secret from. Gamzee didn't push the notion, thankfully.
"Any fucking ways, we gotta deal with all them motherfucking dogs out here," he said.
Tavros looked at the yard and saw their presence was unchanged.
"We?"
Tavros asked, despair in his voice.
"Yeah, bro, worry not. They're not gonna fucking eat you," Gamzee smiled.
"Why not?"
Gamzee thought back to his original flight back into the mortal realm, the baying hounds and gnashing teeth.
"I asked them," Gamzee said plainly. "Would you mind, explaining further?" he asked.
"I turned fucking dongways and asked them. They said you are a disciple of their priestess or some shit, man. Motherfucking miracles."
"Huh. Okay, why not?" Tavros replied. "I'm, kind of tired of sitting in this tree as well."
"Right on, motherfucker, let's fly," Gamzee said,
and turned his body into a humanoid form. By whatever magic shapeshifters were imbued with, Gamzee's mass changed as well, and the relatively thin branch that supported his vulture form instantly snapped. With a delayed fuck, Gamzee plummeted. Tavros scrambled to get his wings closed and dive after him, but a second later the shifter was floating back up towards Tavros, held aloft on the flutter of fuzzy pink moth wings.
"Ha ha, man, motherfucker! These things are harder to use than you make them fucking look, brother," he said.
Tavros laughed.
"Yeah, homie, it's kind of a fucking trial dealing with them," he admitted.
It was like he was talking to another of his kind again. It felt like forever since the last time he'd been able to. Together they buzzed across the sky, Gamzee dipping and bumbling the whole way. When the two arrived back at the house, Salix was chucking armfuls of dog treats into the assembled mass of hound flesh.
"Take your devil's due, you vile beast," he cried out, slipping into what sounded like some kind of Victorian cadence.
Aradia was floating next to him, giggling. She grabbed her own bag and started flying around, distributing them more evenly. As Tavros and Gamzee approached, Salix's shoulders sagged in relief.
"Thank fuck. Oh, hey, GZ. Glad you're around. Could you guys help me out here?"
he asked them, already lifting up an industrial-sized bag with a happy-looking dog printed on it.
"Miraculous, my brother. Where the fuck did you up and find dog treats in this day and age?"
Gamzee asked, hauling up the bag with some effort on the part of his fluffy wings. Salix returned a tired grin.
"I found an abandoned warehouse full of them and some other dog shit a few months ago when I was looking for some free property to start building my own server farm. I figured I'd keep them around in case there was a sudden demand for the stuff."
He looked around.
"Just wasn't expecting it to happen like this."
"Glory be, my man,"
Gamzee said and flapped off, trailing his own rain of treats. Tavros went to get a bag for himself from Salix. As Salix ripped open the bag, a stale smell hit Tavros's senses.
"Yeah, I'm happy to help. It's just..."
He had to quickly gain a few feet of elevation as a larger dog tried to jump up at him, its tail wagging.
Are those good to eat? They smell kind of, old.
Solix gave him a look over his glasses.
I appreciate your concern for all these mutts that were trying to eat you a second ago, but nowhere in the deal that I had to strike did I specify the quality nor safety of the treats. If one of these dogs was a lawyer, then maybe they'd be able to get me on the positive implications of the word treat, but as it stands...
Solix grunted as he shoved the bag up to Tavros.
This is all I owe them.
Tavros took the bag. It wasn't that heavy, but he felt like he ought to move a little more slowly with it to avoid showing off. The first few dogs didn't seem to be concerned about the quality of the treats, so he set about spreading them in earnest. Tavros was good with fey beasts, kelpies, phoenixes, jackalopes, but domestics were much harder. They were mortal, which was hard enough, but being a species changed by man made them much more alien than their wild counterparts. These animals didn't resemble at all the horrible hounds that harried him through the portal. They were all wagging tails and joyous slobber. What exactly had Gamzee meant by disciples? Tavros looked around briefly before noticing an aggregation of dogs underneath one of the higher branches of the live oak, treats raining down on them. He fluttered up and over to Gamzee as the shifter sprinkled bone-shaped biscuits down. He had formed large bird talons from the knee down, which clutched onto the branch.
"Hey, Gamzee?" Tavros asked hesitantly.
Gamzee turned.
"What's up, T?" "Not much, just thinking about how weird all of this is," Tavros said. "You said you talked to the dogs?"
"Talked being a generous motherfucking term for it, for sure," Gamzee answered. "Gotta get in that wicked domesticated brain space to do it since I can't be working on motherfucking dog magic."
Tavros nodded. All manner of chaos-aligned magic was rampant in Faerie, but dog magic was a taboo.
"Yeah, but you said earlier they thought we were disciples. What exactly does that mean?" he asked.
"Disciples of the motherfucking priestess, brother?"
Gamzee jabbed a thumb towards where Aradia was standing waist-deep in a horde of dogs, many of them issuing distraught whines when their paws phased through her intangible body. She laughed, holding the treat bag above her head and handing the biscuits out one by one.
"Canine motherfuckers think she's some kind of chosen of the Hound Lord, which makes us and Sonic's disciples by fucking association,"
Gamzee finished, shrugging.
Fuck, Tavros tried to form a sentence. "Fucking all right. I mean, does Aradia know that she was claimed?"
He ended the sentence in a whisper, hoping nothing too powerful was watching him. Gamzee shrugged again. He loosened his talon grip and let gravity spin him around the branch until he was hanging upside down. His head stayed right side up.
"Told her the same motherfucking stuff I told you."
"Right," Tavros swallowed. "I should maybe, go talk to her."
He floated off, vaguely meandering around the yard, dispensing treats and tracing a circuitous route to Aradia he hoped wasn't too obvious. Tavros was shaken. How could the Lord of Hounds claim her when she was immortal? She belonged to the small gods, the pantheons belonging to a human culture. That didn't end with death, at least not normally. As he passed by the front door, he heard a voice.
"Hey,"
Solix called from the step. The house was built in such a way that part of an upstairs room hung over the entryway, supported on columns. The demon was standing in the shade it provided, a bottle of water in hand.
"Don't bother Aradia about the god shit."
Tavros froze.
"What, do you mean by that?"
he stammered out.
"Dude, you're on my property. I know everything that happened on stuff I own," he cringed. "Even the alternate. That's not the issue. Look, Aradia didn't like to talk about it, so I'm going to do her the favor of explaining it to you."
He walked closer to Tavros, staying in the shade but speaking more quietly.
"When me and her became connected, the nature of my being severed the dominion of the Mayan gods over her. Any kind of connection or protection. It made the spirit of the Solo who was supposed to guide her to Shibalba lose her scent. That's why she's still around. I assume you know everything else that implies."
Tavros' mouth flopped open and closed like a fish as he tried to conjure some response. It made sense, but also
and making that choice meant she lost any right to an afterlife, lost the right to have her prayers answered, leaving her subject to the whims of greater entities like the Lord of Hounds or the Mother of Mystics, just as untethered as the humans who chose to follow their fey lovers when the Red Admirals migrated home. It had something to do with rejecting the human culture of birth, he was pretty sure. The Lord of Hounds coming to collect, he'd never seen it before. It was considered wholly theoretical to fey and demon kind. There were plenty of instances of the Mother claiming dominion on wayward souls, but the Lord was a reclusive god.
Is she, okay with it? The priestess-ness,
Tavros managed. He wondered if this was his fault, bringing those few dogs here in the first place.
I don't think she'd be trying to teach 30 dogs how to form a conga line if she was upset,
Salix deadpanned. Tavros looked over. Aradia appeared to be attempting to get some of the dogs to jump on their hind legs in a line. It was coming together with uncanny speed.
Right, he said, blushing. Sorry.
Salix raised an eyebrow at him. He looked like he was about to say something, but let out the breath in a sigh.
Let's just get everything doled out. Take 2 bags. It looks like you can handle them.
Tavros blushed again for a different reason. He heard a hell fucking yeah over his shoulder as Gamzee joined the conga line. After the treat debacle, it took all afternoon for the four of them to deal with the dogs, a steady stream of curses flowing from some mouths, prayers from others. So while Aradia kept trying to commune with this lord, the rest of them tried acting more holy. It felt pretty stupid. He didn't like the idea of belonging to a god in practice, of having some great being waiting expectantly. He'd heard the price the Mother of Mystics demanded, the loss of freedom she required. He hoped the Lord would be less cruel than her. Shortly thereafter, though, the human neighbors had noticed the commotion and provided a good measure of relief. The humans were ecstatic, all bravely forging into the crowd of canines, all taking home 1 or 2 or 3. More humans came as word spread. When some arrived, they already had a dog with them, a dog they claimed went missing for 3 years. They were calling it a miracle, and wanted to see what they thought was the epicenter. Most of them went home with another dog, one that seemed to recognize their own pet as a friend. Other humans arrived in uniforms that looked like they had been wrinkled for a while, all of them branded with some form of Humane Society or Animal Rescue written on the clothing. They came with vans meant to carry the dogs. All of those humans seemed particularly emotional about the dog's presence. When it was all over, the teeming mass of mutts was down to a manageable number, one they could actually count the heads of and figure out how to take care of. They'd got into a grocery store, a culture shock for Tavros after the open-air markets of his childhood with the Yucatan Maya, buying as much meat as they could. Many of the butchers were glad to lend some scrap meat when they heard it was for the resurgence of dogs. Then it was open-wall tents and blankets, setting them up in the yard so the dogs would have shelter to sleep under in case the rains returned. Finally, they got some large, brightly-colored plastic basins, which Aradia called kiddie pools. They filled some with water and dumped meat in the others, and the hounds had feasted. By the time it was over, they were ready to collapse in the house and never touch another dog again. But somehow Tavros wanted to thank the Lord of Hounds for all of this. The ridiculous turn of events had cemented his place in the mortal realm. He had reconnected with 2 friends that were dear to his heart and managed to get a gauge on Salix's biting sarcasm. When Tavros returned a few repartees of his own, the demons seemed to appreciate them. Maybe this could be a new start. The thought came to him as they were all flopped on various couches, various beverages in hand, Salix bemoaning the lack of endurance his mortal form possessed this time around. A new start, a new family. He couldn't go back to Faerie, not after her. The Red Admirals would be a distant memory soon. Perhaps to them he already was. He thought, hearing Gamzee's deep, sedate laugh next to him, that maybe he wouldn't be lost anymore. Nepeta. Nepeta lazed in the weak sunlight of the afternoon as she watched her beloved Equius at work, building a porch for their home. She had checked her phone earlier, when they were unloading the bounty from the shopping trip, but after Kanaya's text telling everyone not to come over, her friends had stopped messaging, none wanting to be the first to ask how Vriskers was doing. Afraid to jinx it, she figured. Now she had been nodding off as the cheerfully rhythmic sounds of hammering, of a chainsaw buzz, of electric drills whirring, and Aquiesce's muttered poetry lulled her into contentment. It was perfectly pleasant. So pleasant, in fact, that she nearly missed the melodic nya-nya ringtone of her phone, discarded on the blanket somewhere off to the side.
May 4th, 9:15 a.m. GC.
I suspect she lacks capacity.
May 4th, 3:30 p.m. GA.
We have an update.
GA.
The hunter, Mr. Strider, had to perform surgery.
GA.
Because of her condition, he has taken Vriska to his abode to heal.
GA.
Rest assured I will be contacting Dave about everyone visiting.
GA.
For now, I am going home myself.
GA.
It was a very unnerving surgery to witness.
Nepeta felt her brows climbing higher with each message that appeared on the screen. Surgery? She didn't think vampires ever got surgery, especially not from humans. She rolled onto her back, then shoved her phone into her pants pocket. Hands free, she executed a kip-up. She pulled her knees to her chest, rolled up onto her shoulders, swung her feet up over her head, and reached her hands up and behind her until they touched the ground near her ears. With a great shove, she launched herself up into the air, her feet swinging forwards towards the ground, her torso popping upward until she landed on her feet in a crouch. She grinned at herself congratulatorily. Standing upright, she pulled her phone from her pocket, then shot a reply to Kanaya.
You.
No. What happened to Vriskers? Was Perezi not joking about the foot?
G.A.
Oh man, no, it was not a joke.
G.A.
Without going into graphic details, I will clarify.
G.A.
The leg bones had healed twisted, and the foot twisted with it.
You.
Holy shit!
G.A.
Holy shit is correct. The surgery was to break the error and correct it.
Aquiesce! Aquiesce, quit your work and come over here. There's an update on Vriskers.
Nepeta caterwauled at the centaur, who was using some loud power tool in a trance-like state, lost in admiration for its power. Thankfully, her roar was pretty powerful, and it managed to startle him enough for his left hind leg to raise for a moment, as if to kick at a threat. Nepeta was, of course, nowhere near him, and after a moment he had stopped the tool and looked over at her, wiping sweat and sawdust from his brow.
"Did you say something, Nepeta?"
he inquired, and she nodded excitedly, raising her phone and shaking it.
"Yeah, you big sweaty dork. I said there's an update on Vriskers. The hunter had to do surgery on her."
This got his attention, his thick brows raising behind his safety goggles. He lifted them off his eyes, letting them dangle around his neck as he trotted over quickly, the bright yellow power tool abandoned on the sawhorse. She passed the phone to him, and he quickly read the messages. His jaw tightened, his tail twitching in irritation as he handed the phone back to her.
"This is unacceptable. She should never have been in that condition. My clan should have found her. Our territory is just south of hers. How did I miss her?"
Nepeta looked up at Aquiesce and felt her heart break just a little. He was right, but only technically. The Zahaks were a massive clan, and their territory was vast. Her partner couldn't patrol every inch of it, not without stepping on an individual herd's hoofs. A lone vampire could sneak through it, she was sure. After all, Nepeta had snuck through clan land herself without being spotted by sentries plenty of times. Vampires were not as stealthy as werecougars, but she supposed they were close enough. She reached up on her tiptoes and hugged him.
"You know how clever Vriskers is, how sneaky. It makes sense she dodged your clansmen. She probably thought politics would demand the sentries return her, but she's safe now."
Nepeta honestly wasn't sure if safe was the right word for being carted away by a hunter, but Kanaya was a good judge of character, and clearly she trusted him. Her eyes twitched as the phone meowed again. She disentangled herself from Aquiesce, nose wrinkling at the sawdust sticking to her shirt.
G.A.
To clarify, Mr. Strada believes her leg will fully recover, in a week or less.
G.A.
He simply felt an apartment was more conducive to rest than Carcat's Bridge or Therese's van.
G.A.
It would be too close to the river.
G.A.
I offered my home, but he said it was his duty, not my mom's.
You.
Aw. I wish she went with you. Healing is always easier when you're with your friends.
G.A.
Well, I won't be far. And I trust Dave to keep me informed.
Perhaps the two will even hit it off.
GA.
Rest assured, everyone will be able to see her soon.
Nepeta made sure to keep the phone screen tilted so Aquias could read over her shoulder as she replied to the messages. She always forgot that Kanaya's human friend Dave, the archaeology nerd that Aradia was so charmed by, was also the hunter's brother. He was so non-threatening. Easy prey, she always thought, hands in his pockets, shades impeding his vision. She wondered what would happen if Riskers flashed her fangs too close while the boy performed one of his annoying raps. She hoped the hunter didn't hover too closely. Predators like her and Riskers didn't do well under someone lesser's control.
"He is going to be fine. I know exactly where the hunter lives. I scooped out his nest ages ago. I think if we need to evacuate her, it'll be easy."
She kept her voice chipper, knowing Aquias might work himself up if she betrayed her own nerves. Centaurs weren't all as anxious as horses, but her poor boy was a bundle of stress, so she leaned back until her back touched his chest and purred loud enough for him to feel it.
"I suppose Kanaya is a rational person. Despite her membership in our friend group, we will let Vrischika reside with the hunter, at least for now."
He said this begrudgingly. At his word choice, Nepeta pursed her lips. She hadn't mentioned it earlier, but now...
"Aquias, you should stop calling her that. You know Vrischka doesn't like to use the whole thing. When we go see her, it'll be the first time she's talked to you in person outside of that horrible place. I know it wasn't safe to use her nickname there, but now you can do right by her."
She turned so she could watch him react to her words, watch his brow furrow as he considered it. The politics were weird, so very different from how her people did things, but she knew he understood about names. After all, he never told their friends his full name, only the nickname she'd given him. His name was a burden she'd understood, tied so closely to his responsibility to his clan. The nickname let him separate himself from that burden. For Vriska, she figured it had to be worse, not a burden, but a cage. Vrischika Satsukent. Aradia was the one who explained it to Nepeta, why Pharaoh Sukat's first name was part of Vriska's last. The archaeology buff had explained it was an ancient Egyptian naming convention that Sat simply meant daughter of. Satsukent wasn't a last name, it was the Pharaoh's way of staking her claim on Vriska, of making sure everyone knew who she belonged to. That was the problem with kings, Nepeta figured. They didn't love their cubs or their clan, they simply owned them.
"I suppose you're right. We are no longer bound by court protocol. I will practice with saying Vriska, so as not to offend her."
He nodded as he said it, and Nepeta trilled at him happily. It was her job to help him loosen up, she knew, and this would help. She grinned, breathing deeply. The smell of grass and sweat and sawdust filled her nose.
"Good. Now, do you want to go back to working on the porch, or is it time for us to frolic?"
She watched him struggle for a moment with the choice before giggling. He was so easy to toy with, like catching fish in a barrel.
"I'm just kidding. I know you don't like to put down a project half done. I'm going to go grab us both a snack and my sketchbook. By the time you're done with the porch, I'll have some perfect action shots of you."
Aquias's handsome cheekbones turned a dusty pink, and he immediately started sweating. Nepeta winked cheekily, then scampered away, not giving him a chance to reply. As she headed to the back door, she gave a little shake, getting the grass and sawdust off. She had some juicy venison steaks, which she'd hunted herself, of course, and figured she could eat one bloody this close to the full moon. As her clawed hand wrapped around the doorknob, she thought of Aquias, delicately checking the consistency of his bacon, and decided to cook his well done, and maybe a salad as well for his equine stomach. Food always helped her cheer up, and she hoped a good meal would help him do the same. She stepped inside, looking around their home cheerily. The back door led directly to the kitchen, which she had painted to resemble the wetlands. The walls were striped with lemongrass, a tall grass which was a lovely green at the bottom and a reddish-brown where the seed pods burst free. Swathes of meadow pink covered some of the drawers and cupboards below the counter, and gulls dotted the skies on the shelves above her head. She began to gather her supplies for snack-making, eager to sink her teeth into her prey. Nepeta had delivered Aquias his salad, eaten her steak, and now was waiting while he sizzled in the pan. There was a stack of sketchbooks on the kitchen table, left from her collaboration session with Terezi the day before. She decided to flip through them while she kept an eye on the meat, take a peek at older drawings of Aquias so she'd know what to compare her new work to. The sketchbook she picked up first was from 2009, she realized, as the battered cover displayed a tree on fire, which she'd painted over the cardboard sometime after the collapse. Not a great year for her art, she thought sadly, but still worth looking at. The first few drawings were of her environment back home, of prey animals in the switchgrass, of the clear water it brushed against. Lush turf free of human encroachment. She flipped through slowly, fondly remembering her territory, but then a different drawing, one very out of place. It was an OC sheet for two cats, not cougars, domestics, at different stages of life. The large long-haired she-cat with golden fur was her OC, Lion Star. And the sleek lilac tabby belonged to an online friend from the human internet. The OC's name, Blossomheart, was written under the she-cat, alongside a username, Garden Gnostic. Nepeta remembered Blossomheart from the Warrior Cat roleplay forums, a quirky girl who wanted to be a medicine cat because herb remedies were the earliest form of science. They spent a lot of time chattering in the forums, both in and out of character, but Gigi was a tough nut to crack. She knew Gigi lived somewhere where there weren't any cats, only dogs, and talked a little wistfully about seeing one in person someday. Nepeta sighed, turning the page. Another drawing of Lionstar and Blossomheart with their noses pressed to the moonstone. This was from the scene of Lionstar gaining her 9 lives. Through the hole in the cave above them, the stars formed the face of a tomcat with big whiskers, looking down at the scene. The two had tinkered with the list, rereading passages from Firestar's own ceremony, wondering who should grant what gift, why it mattered. Gigi had mentioned her grandfather being dead during that conversation, and said she was glad he had left a gift of wisdom for her, so they'd written a new OC, an old dead tomcat that was related to Lionstar and Blossomheart both, to give the gift of wisdom to Lionstar with his life, to tell Blossomheart how proud he was of her. Nepeta wondered if Gigi was still alive, if she still thought about AC and Lionstar. The sizzling of the meat grew louder, and Nepeta shot to her feet, scrambling over to the stove to turn down the heat. Whoops. Better stop reminiscing. Sheepishly, she decided to focus on not burning Equius's food, and decided she'd look through those OC drawings sometime later. Tavros. The mortal realm, Tavros decided, had gotten a lot more interesting. The humans were different, strange, and unfamiliar, but they had created some really cool stuff. He was sitting on the couch watching the sun set through the window as Gamzee and Salix faced off on the video game. His own character had died in glorious battle to Aradia's, and she was knocked out by Salix, the demon snickering as his brightly colored fighter unleashed some sort of magical attack on Aradia's. Gamzee was holding on just barely, the shifter blatantly growing extra fingers in an attempt to execute combo moves, but he was simply outmatched.
Ha! Suck on that!
Salix executed some sort of advanced finisher, killing Gamzee's character in a flurry of bright colors that made Tavros's eyes hurt to try and follow. The victory screen displayed the finishing move on a loop, a nonsensical spiral of light listing statistics such as
Flawless Fighter!
And
356 Max Combo!
Tavros rubbed at his eyes, then looked over at Aradia. The woman was holding another piece of modern furniture technology, what was apparently a communication device sort of like the mirror he'd used to talk to Gamzee before it shattered. She was frowning at the screen.
Hey guys, Dave just sent me a picture of that dog he was looking for. The one that belongs to the missing girl, one of his closest friends. Did any of you see a dog like that when we were corralling them? I certainly didn't.
Aradia tilted the screen and the three of them looked at it. Tavros didn't recognize the large, pure white dog, not from today anyway, but something about it did look familiar.
Absolutely.
Oh yeah, I've seen him.
Tavros let slip before he could stop himself. Aradia turns to him, her wide, unblinking ghost eyes boring into his soul. Or at least it felt like it.
Really, when? Who did he leave with? This dog and its owner are very important to my friend, she said.
Well, I didn't see him, I mean...
Everyone cocked their heads simultaneously.
I saw him, but not with the dogs. Well, yes, with the dogs, but not these dogs, more dogs. Not today.
Tavros had no idea how he'd be able to salvage this.
You mean you saw him in Ferry when you were getting chased by those hundreds of dogs?
Salix said dubiously.
Aha. He winced. Yeah, in Ferry.
He remembered some of the dogs that had been sitting on a hill, the ones that chased him, in fact, but when they started running, they left behind a large white hound that apparently didn't feel like tormenting a fae. Aradia floated up a few inches.
That's fantastic! Dave has really been broken up about this missing girl. If we have a lead, maybe you can pop back in, she began.
I can't.
Tavros raised his hand, cutting Aradia off. It wasn't her fault for not knowing, of course, but the suggestion couldn't be considered feasible.
I can't pop back over and look for him. If I did, I'm just as likely to get lost as I am to find him, and not likely to come back in the right amount of time for your human friend to even appreciate the information.
An old pain was creeping up Tavros's sternum as he said this, an ache of something lost. Now all eyes were fixed on him, a range of confusion to suspicion.
What do you mean? Isn't the whole point of Faerie that only the natives can travel it without getting lost in space or time?
Salix's face was the one harboring suspicion, and his voice was a little accusatory. Tavros didn't like the way that made him feel.
For everyone else, yeah, but, I can't.
He took a halting breath. Everyone was still looking at him, waiting for an explanation. Even Gamzee's usual aloofness turned into concern and confusion.
I stumbled into somewhere I shouldn't have been and got spelled. It's when our mirror broke, actually.
He looked at Gamzee, who looked a bit shocked. Salix's gaze shifted to Gamzee as well, as if looking to see if the shifter backed Tavros up.
Well, shit, man, that was back in 06 this side of the tracks. What the motherfuck kind of magic hit you?
Gamzee's eyebrows pinched in concern, and Tavros saw Salix relax a tad. The suspicion was painful.
So, here's the thing. I actually spent a little time on the mortal side between Aradia and now.
He saw her draw up with apprehension. It was only reasonable he hadn't been entirely honest with her earlier, but if he wanted to stay here, he couldn't make a habit of telling half-truths.
I really didn't know when it was in the human time frame because I wasn't hanging out with humans, really. I was just enjoying what I thought was empty desert far north of the Yucatan Maya. Until I found a huge structure, tall walls guarding a bunch of well-armed vampires, a tiny kingdom just for them,
This was a little awkward. How to explain it? He'd been lonely and bored, missing how interesting mortal friends could be. He left his people's migration path, originally planning to visit Gamzee, his mirror friend, but the shifter said special people weren't supposed to be seen by the humans he lived near.
Well, I didn't know if they'd be friendly, so I waited until nighttime to approach. I happened to peek in the window of a vampire princess, I think, and she was really friendly, so I started coming by every evening, flying up to her window just to chat with her. She was lonely, but she wasn't supposed to leave, she told me. The king would get angry.
Tavros was looking down at his lap, wringing his hands together. He remembered the girl, how she'd wanted to escape, how many times she asked why he couldn't just steal her away like the stories. How angry she'd been when he told her that Fae lands were dangerous for mortal children, even vampire children. How she'd told him 11 was old enough to do dangerous things as long as she had a friend. Aradia's hands reached out, cupping his, stopping his nervous gestures. He looked up at her and felt his antenna quiver. She was staring very intensely.
What happened? She asked softly. Did you try to take her away?
Tavros trembled, feeling like a pin was going to stab through him, like he was trapped again. He swallowed, then continued.
We got caught the night she'd convinced me. The king and her priest, they trapped us. The priest used dark magics, the kind from beyond the realms, and the king made the princess hold me in place while the magic worked its evil inside me. It shattered the mirror, I think, when it reached my own magic. The connection.
Tavros felt tears welling up at the memory, at the pain in his breast, at the tiny claws digging into his wrists with the supernatural strength of a vampire child. The claw marks were still visible, little half-moon scars. He remembered her sobbing as she held him, begging her mother to let her go. Aradia's thumb brushed one of the scars, taking note of it silently. He forced himself to continue around the lump in his throat.
It broke my ability to navigate in the Feylands and the magic and shoved me through a portal into a region I didn't recognize. It made the magic of fairy read me as mortal twist up time and space around me like I was an intruder in my own home. I don't know how long I wandered. I couldn't even find another Red Admiral, anything that felt familiar. I stumbled into the dogs eventually, and the ones that chased me were sitting with a white one like the photo, but I don't know where those hills were. Don't know how to find them without losing my way back to this time, and I don't want to go back to Faerie. I don't belong there anymore.
Tavros was definitely crying, he realized. Remembering those inky black tentacles of magic wriggling into his skin, ruining the instincts that guided him. His people were migratory. He might never find them again.
That's horrible. I'm so sorry,
Aradia murmured, giving Tavros' hands a squeeze. She hesitated, mouth parted slightly, then asked,
Can you tell me her name, the princess?
She said this softly. Tavros appreciated her kindness. He dug through his memory.
She didn't want to say it, her real name. She said that I should call her Wendy, like the girl in a picture book she showed me, but the king called her by it when they caught us. Vrishchika, I think.
His mouth felt awkward, forming the strange syllables, but it was clear the name had meaning to the trio. They all sat in silence for a few seconds.
Miracles upon miracles, Gamzee said with awe. My brother, your vampire princess is the very same friend of ours who all up and returned from beyond. Isn't that motherfucking spectacular?
Gamzee grinned at Tavros, who blinked at him through the tears. He realized fuzzily that Gamzee had mentioned a vampire friend with a V name, though he hadn't made the connection following the chaos. But it seemed coincidences were guiding his path lately. He attempted to return Gamzee's smile. It shattered immediately as he thought about having to look at that little girl's face again. Tavros took a breath.
She got out?
Yeah, just last night. This morning, Salik said. Well, 3 years ago, technically. Basically, she went missing to escape and just showed up again. We're all waiting to see her because she got super fucked up on the way here and needs to recover.
That's great for her. Wow, yeah, that was a bad situation.
He was hesitant to say it about his friend's friend, but he didn't think he could manage it if they met any time soon.
I don't think it would be a good idea to see her, for me to see her. I mean, like, I know it wasn't her that, you know, did that. But that's a lot to learn all of a sudden.
Aradia removed her hands from his, one reaching to squeeze his shoulder comfortingly. He rested his head in his hands, tears starting to dry a bit.
We understand, Tavros, Aradia said. I think she would like to see you at some point still. A few times on the alternate forums.
Tavros had learned earlier that this was like a book many people could write in, and everyone who had a computer that could view it could use it to communicate.
I think she mentioned a friend she used to play pirate with. She never said what happened to him, but if that was you, it sounds like she only really has good memories about you.
He wiped his nose with a wrist. Gamzee's wrist, which he had turned into a soft, limp sheet and offered to Tavros.
Does she still like pirates? He asked.
Nobody answered immediately, but Salix grunted.
You'd have to ask Nepeta that, I think, or maybe Terethi. They basically did what amounted to play and pretend on the forums, but like writing a story together. I couldn't be asked to memorize the hundreds of thousands of pages of shit they wrote, he said, thinking back. I had to dedicate a hard drive to that part of the forum.
He said this part with what sounded like grudging respect.
She got into some motherfucking history shit, Gamzee piped up, remembering something. Yeah, her and that bitch Eridan. They're always talking about some kind of fucking history game war with little figurines. I sourced a couple to ship to her.
Tavros didn't really know if that was the same thing, but it brought some measure of comfort, so he accepted it. He sat back up, looking at his companions. Nightfall was near, he realized, the window no longer a glimmer of sunlight. He knew Gamzee would leave soon and didn't want to end their reunion on a low note.
"Let's play another round of this,"
Tavros said, reaching for the abandoned controller and holding it up.
"Enough of sad memories and frowning, right? We Fae are supposed to be known for our revelry. I think I better put that skill to work and see if I can magically learn this game as easy as a dance."
The others looked at each other, and Tavros hoped his voice had been chipper enough to pass muster. Talking about that stuff was awkward, and he wanted to stop dwelling on it.
"All right, sure, if you want to get cocky. I somehow doubt any fairy trickery can match my elite skills,"
Salix boasted as he picked his controller up as well. They all began smiling again, the sadness of the moment wiped away, and the four friends began to play the game again. All was well, at least for now. Dave.
"Take the fucking mic! Hold on, the strap is stuck, it's...
Man, come on, the second half is about to start, and you know I can't do Freddy.
Neither can I! Help me out!"
Dave was trying to yank the guitar strap out from John's armpit, where he had somehow managed to wrap it around twice, when he heard John's apartment door open. Rose walked in on them, and then they both looked up at her as though caught. John's arm was pulled over his head, reverse chicken winging him, and the other one was fighting to hold the plastic guitar controller up. David placed a foot on the couch to get a higher angle on the situation, and he was practically frozen midair, looking at Rose with a blank expression while she stood with her mouth half open, like she planned to say something but forgot it. The backing track of We Are the Champions and the virtual crowd's boos played as the three friends stared at each other.
"Never heard of knocking?"
John broke the silence.
"For real, Rose, what if I was in the middle of sucking John's shit off? What if he walked in on that? Traumatize you with my Henry fucking Hoover vacuum power,"
Dave said.
"Is that something I'm at risk of walking in on now?"
Rose asked, incredulous.
"No!"
John interjected. He turned to Dave, pointing the controller at him.
"No, she is not!"
"Curious," Rose murmured to herself.
"Well, if I'm interrupting something..." She started to turn around.
"You are not!"
John yelled. Dave stepped back as John started wrestling his own way out of the tangle. He managed to detach the strap wholesale from the controller and pull it the rest of the way off himself. He took a breath.
"Okay, Rose, why are you breaking into my house?" John asked.
Rose fiddled. "Dave doesn't lock his apartment. I suppose it's a force of habit from dropping by so regularly," she said.
"No, wait, yeah, that's fine," John replied. "I mean, what are you doing here?"
That tricky motherfucker. John had told Dave what Gamzee said about Rose at Aradia's place. Dave didn't realize his best friend could lie so smoothly. She sighed.
"I recently received some sage advice that I should lean on my friends more than I have been, which has been zero."
"B.S.,"
Dave shot.
"I haven't been not translating your bone slab with those books on the coffee table just for you to say you haven't been leaning on me, leeching my resources and esoteric knowledge and shit."
Rose gave him a tired smile and walked over to the armchair. John and he took the cue and sat on the couch.
"I mean about personal stuff. Feelings."
She said it derisively, intentionally avoiding looking at him. Instead, she watched the canned animation of the crowd booing on the screen. He and John exchanged a look.
"So what's up, is it Kanai?"
Dave asked. Rose whipped her head toward him. "Haven't heard from her all day, figured I'd ask." After a moment, she answered, face dropping into her hands.
"Yeah. I severely fucked up. Have I really been obsessed with this search to the point of addiction? This isn't a rhetorical question. John, you get a pass because you just arrived, but Dave, I expect an answer from."
"Fucking, yeah, Rose. Honestly, can't believe it took you this long. I've seen a couple meth heads without their fix, and you'd put them to shame. Rooting around like a goddamn truffle hog for Harry Potter merch.
Wouldn't even be helping you if you didn't know where I lived," Dave spewed.
Rose didn't look hurt. She looked like the doctor just confirmed the diagnosis she was expecting.
"I mean, shit, that one time you found four rocks with uncannily similar patterns and thought they were going to triangulate the Chamber of Secrets or some shit? Had to find three more just like them in the river to convince you not to try and raid that McDonald's. Like a shitty WoW quest. You know that bridge troll charges fucking quarters for river access, right? Do I look like I'm loaded down with Washington's Lalonde?"
She deflated.
"I suppose I've been..." "Replace whatever adjective you're about to say with fucking crazy."
She squinted at him.
I suppose I've been fucking crazy of my friend's time and feelings. Does that sound grammatically correct to you, Dave? He sniffed. All right, you can rewind. I've been inconsiderate of my friend's time and feelings in this pursuit of the arcane. Well, now I'm not quite so sure, but I thought I was doing it to look for Jade. The missing girl's name settled over the room like a fog.
You were, though, right? John asked.
I was, Rose said plaintively. Maybe somewhere along the way it became more about achieving the method than the result. You can't say you aren't curious about magic. She threw the assertion at them. Dave and John shrugged in sync.
Electricity does crazy shit. I don't know how that works either, Dave said.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that we already knew about before the catastrophe that I don't feel like I have to learn the inner workings of, John agreed. I guess it'd be cool if magic could cure cancer or something, but this seems like something the experts are going to figure out.
Rose groaned and sunk into his dad's lazy boy.
What's this got to do with Kanaya? Does she finally get tired of your shit? Dave asked.
Yes, Rose said glumly. I slept over an hour past our breakfast date again.
Can't blame her for that one, Dave said.
Rose worked her way back to an upright position. I know I can't.
She seemed frantic about something else, though. I don't think it was entirely my foible, Rose said.
She said something about one of her friends missing since the catastrophe being alive again.
Whoa, John said. Like 3 whole years?
Rose nodded. I can't help but feel as though it's unfair. She thought her friend was dead and moved on. I have been, at least in sentiment, looking for mine. And hers miraculously comes back. She shifted. Dave could tell she wasn't comfortable speaking her honest thoughts.
You want something to drink? Dave said, getting up and walking away from the circle.
He opened the fridge and stuck his head in, appreciating the cool. John's dad kept a well-stocked fridge.
Apple juice?
John called over.
Coffee?
Rose asked hopefully.
I know how to make coffee,
Dave said, but he chucked a plastic bottle of Mott's at John, who had to lunge with both hands to grab it. He got another for himself.
Try, please?
Rose asked. Jesus, she sounded pathetic.
I asked if you wanted a drink, not fucking table service.
Dave murmured to himself, but went to start trying to figure out the coffee maker.
Where you keep your coffee beans?
We don't use beans, John answered, cracking open his juice.
The fuck do you use to make coffee, then?
Dave was already opening and closing cabinets to look for something that said coffee on it.
Grounds,
John said.
Grounds of what, might I ask? Rose asked. Coffee beans? What?
John asked as Dave and Rose both stared at him.
Then where are the coffee bean grounds? Dave asked.
In the cabinet under the coffee maker, John said. Dave crouched and opened the cabinet door. At the same time, his phone buzzed. He pulled it out while he stuck his head under the counter to look for the coffee. He looked at the notification.
Kanaya.
Dave, be advised. Your brother will be arriving at your domicile. With Vriska in tow, my vampire friend, you recall. She showed up today. I would appreciate it if you could keep me updated on the situation over there.
Almost as soon as he read the text, he heard heavy footsteps going up the stairwell through the wall. Dave lurched up, immediately slamming the top of his skull into the counter with a satisfying thunk.
Fuck!
He grabbed his head.
Dave, are you all right?
He heard Rose call.
Yeah, hold on, just gotta do something for my bro, I'll be right back,
Dave said. He set down the aluminum canister of coffee on the island and headed to the door, running over to the stairs and chasing the sound of footsteps up. He rounded the landing and saw Bro taking the next flight slowly, with a limp body over his shoulder.
There you are. Good. Get the door for me,
Bro said, stepping sideways to allow Dave to pass. The girl didn't look very heavy, but she was gangly and the elevator was still broken. Dave got the stairwell door and then the door to their apartment. He was about to ask Bro a question, but he kept walking once inside. He stopped in front of Dave's bedroom, gesturing at the door with his head.
What? Bro, that's my room,
Dave said, already seeing his problem forming.
No, it's my room which you live in, and now it's going to be this vamp's for a minute while I make sure she isn't going to turn Houston into Transylvania too.
He readjusted the body on his shoulder.
I'm keeping a close eye on her for many reasons, and that's all you got to know.
Pick out one of the other apartments and I'll give you the key, or stay with your friend downstairs, I don't give a shit.
Fuck, fine, whatever, Dave said, and got the door to his bedroom. Bro walked in and dropped the girl on his bed. She looked like she ought to be in a hospital bed, in traction, too, and there was a splint on her leg and bandages all over her. Her face was half burned, and her breathing looked shallow. Her cheeks were hollow enough to be eerily skeletal. She looked kind of, Dave thought of how to think about it, dried up, like a grape on its way to a raisin.
Look, this ain't gonna be a regular thing. This vamp's a special case, partly because there's something of a manhunt for her, partly because I owe Jenny and consequently her daughter. Hopefully soon the rest of the hunters will get off their asses to send me some resources to set up a real lodge here in Houston. I've already got an ox hunter on the way here for some backup. Then I can have some interring chambers that aren't your bedroom. Till then, Bro shrugged. I'll swap your sheets out when blood gets on them.
When? Dave thought. Great.
Yeah, just give me the keys to the third one down whenever, Dave said.
Bro nodded.
Bring the trauma kit to your room before you head out, he said, walking into the bathroom and starting to scrub his hands and forearms. Dave shook his head, glad to not be in the vampire girl's position.
Maybe you could investigate the dogs next, John offered.
Dogs? Rose asked.
Dave walked back in. Thankfully, someone else had taken care of the coffee while he was gone.
All the dogs are back, didn't you notice? John asked.
Rose looked perplexed. Maybe she was too preoccupied with her relationship drama to notice mankind's closest companion suddenly dropping back into existence.
I can't say I did, she said.
Jade had a dog, didn't she? Becquerel was the name?
Jade called him Beck, Dave announced his return. Didn't find him at the dog epicenter.
Hey dude, everything all right? John asked.
Just some... Shit, man, I'm not gonna lie. Bro's giving medical treatments to Kanaya's missing friend, sticking needles and shit into her right of my fucking bed. Don't know how I'm gonna sleep in there knowing a vampire got vivisected on it like a goddamn operating table, he said.
Vriska's upstairs right now?
Rose shot up. Is Kanaya here with her?
Don't think so, Dave said.
His phone buzzed again. Got kicked out of my own fucking room, though. Gonna have to sleep somewhere else.
He jumped over the back of the couch and landed sitting up. He checked his phone real cool style.
She's avoiding me, I'm certain of it, Rose said. She was really starting to kill the vibe. Him and John would have to do something. Another message from Kanaya.
Kanaya.
I assume you were busy, considering Vriska, but I was curious if you knew the whereabouts of Rose.
Kanaya.
Our last conversation, we did not part on good terms. I feel as though we both said things in anger. I may have been too harsh.
Kanaya.
If she is there, please let her know I would like to talk.
He looked at Rose. He read Kanaya's message again. He watched John trying to pull the plastic ring off the neck of the empty apple juice bottle. He decided that Rose and Kanaya both needed to cool off.
You.
She's here, but I think y'all both need a minute to cool the fuck off about all this shit.
You.
I can practically hear the argument between the two of you starting back up already.
You.
Can't be walking back into the bathroom 2 minutes after laying a room clear.
Kanaya.
I wish you wouldn't compare my relationship to a gastrointestinal disaster, Dave.
You.
Shit, sis.
Kanaya.
I suppose you've known both Rose and I longer than we've known each other.
Kanaya.
If you say she doesn't seem ready to return to this yet, I will trust your judgment.
You know what'll cheer you up?
He said to Rose.
What, Dave?
She sounded doubtful.
Some pure Colombian magic research, none of that disco shit, he said.
John barked a laugh.
Dude, that's the complete opposite. She just explained her whole problem is because of the magic, he said.
All right, Dr. Feelgood, what's your suggestion?
Dave replied.
John shrugged and gestured at Rose.
Maybe something she wants to do, he said.
Rose, what do you want to do?
Dave asked.
Rose looked flabbergasted, suddenly caught between the two of them.
Magic research, she said with a lethal amount of guilt in her voice. John objected immediately. Dave laughed.
Suck it, Egbert, he said.
Though, Rose spoke up again, the whalebone itself exacted something of a steep price. I would be lying if I said I wasn't planning on getting assistance with it.
She looked at John. I need to bake 5 pies for Gamzee.
Man, fuck that shit, Dave said.
I'll do your magic research for you if you never say his name in my presence again.
What's your problem with him? Sure, he was kind of creepy and was a shapeshifter like in The Thing, but it didn't seem that bad, John said,
blissfully ignorant of the sheer oxymoronism of his statement.
Dave doesn't like being outmatched in a freestyle, Rose said, the turncoat bitch.
Giving yourself a beat because you can grow a second mouth somewhere, probably out of his own ass, is fucking cheating. I don't give a fuck what Obama says. That's not an alternative person. That's a monster, Dave said. Rose and John laughed. Dave crossed his arms. It was a lot easier to keep his cool over text chat or Skype calls.
I'll help you make some pies, Rose, John said. Dave can sit at the island and do the translation while we bake.
Do you have the supplies for 5 pies? I wouldn't want to just... Rose started, but John had walked over to a cabinet and opened it dramatically. It was full up to the door with Betty Crocker cake mix.
Wait, John said, then moved to the next cabinet over. This one was revealed to be filled with cans and cans of pie fillings, both the pre-made kind and stuff like pureed pumpkin or canned peaches.
We don't run out of pie supplies in this household, he said somewhat proudly. There should also be frozen crusts in the freezer.
Oh, thank God, pre-made. I thought I was going to have to roll out dough, Rose said.
Dave sighed, but scooped up his books, the whalebone, and the notebook he'd set out on the coffee table before he and John got wrapped up in trying to speedrun the rock band career mode. It's not like he didn't like getting his hands on whatever neat little artifacts Rose sometimes brought to him. He was just tired of her always getting disappointed when they ended up being Sumerian copper complaints instead of lurid esoterica or the true names of elder gods. If this shit show with Kanaya had one result, he hoped it would be Rose finally getting disillusioned with the whole magic shtick.
Feferi. After 3 years, Feferi still wasn't quite used to sleeping on land. The Selkies in their skins liked to sleep in the water, their faces held above the surface by their buoyancy. The bed, she acknowledged, was nice, but no replacement for pod life. The girl sighed, running her hands over the smooth surface of the silk sheets, pretending the bright turquoise fabric was the surface of the water. It felt cool to the touch, almost milky against her fingertips, but it didn't make the illusion real. So she pulled them off her body, freeing herself to roll out of bed and start the day. Feferi's room was brightly colored, with a coral reef painted onto the walls by Nepeta. A lot of pink, green, and orange filled the space, a cheery touch of the tropics. A bureau held her clothes, and a full-length mirror was propped against the wall next to it. She went over to grab some clothes and make herself presentable. Feferi turned the mirror around to face the wall, then stripped off her bedclothes, swapping them out for a cute and colorful outfit. Once covered, she twirled the mirror back around, then examined herself. The short magenta skirt and the cream tank top were an optimistic choice, she knew, but it was supposed to be May, and the clouds had looked thinner yesterday. Dress for the weather you desire, and it shall appear. With some luck, Feferi might even get some fresh freckles. The thought made her grin widely at the mirror, watching the freckles move on her pale skin. After 3 years of an atmosphere choked by ash, her spots were fading. They could use some sprucing up. Pleased by the notion, Feferi snatched up her favorite whalebone comb from the top of the bureau, with the little pearls dotting the handle, and renewed her eternal battle against bedhead. Feferi put her hands on her hips, looking at the kitchen. She really should have done the dishes last night. Instead, she ended up taking a trip with Aridin to a game store, where he both depleted their stock of historical miniatures and rounded up an eclectic combination of fantasy monsters, all of which were egregiously offensive in depiction. Then she got swept up with him putting on an actually pretty interesting documentary about the War of 1812, and lamenting how he hasn't had someone competent to talk war game with since Vriska went AWOL. They talked a lot about how crazy it was going to be next Wednesday, having their whole pod from the Young Alternatives Forum in one place. It was the sort of thing they'd talked about before the catastrophe, as a plan for adulthood, finally being able to meet up. She'd never imagined such extreme circumstances precipitating finally seeing them all. As Feferi began cleaning up the explosive remains of yesterday's chaotic cooking, she thought mournfully of the difference between fantasy and reality. Living with Aridin, running a soup kitchen, it wasn't exactly the eco-terrorism life she thought she could change the world with. To be honest, she acknowledged, elbow deep in suds, she hadn't exactly grown up with a positive view of the land people, alternative and human alike.
Many of those land-dwelling alts lived in human settlements, contributing to the system that was destroying the oceans. The forums had changed things a little bit, the Selkie finding herself making exceptions for alts like Gamzee and Terezi, living among humans because they had no community of their own kind. Then she recognized Kanaya. The one human among them was someone she cared about. And the list of exceptions got a little bigger. But it was surviving the meteors with Eridan, losing her ability to find her own community, to find her mother, that really opened her eyes. Made her not just allow shades of gray, but to actually view the nuance in full color. Feferi plucked Eridan's favorite knife from the suds and began scrubbing it, a scowl forming. If only Eridan could get on board with the whole peace and love and equality of it all. She'd tried to push him, but the closest he'd gotten was benevolent dictatorship. And once he started suggesting she tap into the natural superiority of her mother's blood, she'd had to shut him down and change the subject. As if she had any interest in ruling anyone, especially up here. If she was back home with her colony among the waves, she might consider leadership one day, but she would never use her mom's special talents as a crutch. Feferi wasn't really looking at the knife, sort of absent-mindedly gazing into the middle distance when suddenly the air shifted around her. She gasped, looking around, clutching the knife, discarding the sponge. Something was wrong with her eyes, she thought at first. As the air of the kitchen began to shimmer like an oil slick, dark spools of rainbow light oozing across her vision. A high whine filled the air, the sort of pitch that she could feel in her skull, whispers, dark foreboding flutters of feathery almost words, began to brush against the edges of her hearing, a dizzying sensation. Something pressed against her false skin like it was searching for something. The knife dropped from her hands, its solid heft splashing back into the sink and landing with a thunk. She reached to retrieve it, then looked down, confused by the sensation of the water. It felt like it was crawling up her hands as she submerged them. The sight of her hands shocked her. She would normally describe her hands as short and stubby, her hands chubby enough that there were dimples on her knuckles, but right now they were doing something else, something wrong. Something she should have only been able to tap into with her true skin all the way on. The fingers had elongated and begun twisting, taking on a strange, boneless shape of thin, fleshy tangles that could no more grip a knife than a pile of kelp could. The flesh on the back of her hand, the crawling sensation, was the feeling of the tissue being pushed forward through the fingers. Her plump wrists and soft palms becoming emaciated as the strings of flesh coiled. This did not hurt and seemed confined to the places that had touched the water, none of her fat disappearing from anywhere dry. Grimacing at the sight, she pulled her hands from the water, watching as the contortions continued until they formed a familiar shape, the symbol of her mother. The secret name in the secret tongue that made the eyes of normal people weep tears of blood to read. Made the eardrums burst to hear. To Feferi, however, it was a comforting sign, and she began to smile. The strange sounds, the shimmer in the air, they no longer scared her. Was it her mother calling her home? But then the girl's face fell. Her eyes lost their sparkle. And with an unceremonious snap, the flesh yanked itself back into place, her hands becoming normal again. The noises all ceased, the sensations halted, the colors in the air disappeared. Whatever connection she'd established, she hadn't been able to hold it, she realized sadly. Or maybe there was no connection, maybe it was power all of Feferi's own. But without her mom around, there was no one to ask, no one to compare notes with. Even if she met another Selkie, stranded from their own people, they wouldn't understand the power inside her. Only her colony would. But they were so far away, so far out of reach. Feferi felt tears welling up, the salty sting familiar. She missed her mom so much, missed everyone in the colony. Being near her friends, making meals for those in need, she was doing her best to find community on foreign shores. But it was so hard. Especially with the ocean so close and yet so very out of her reach. She tried to put it out of her mind, angrily shoving at her face as if to force the tears back inside. But she wasn't a bridge troll. Couldn't control her body's water in that way. So she leaned back over the sink, angrily scrubbing Eridan's knife and trying not to think about the way her scar, the one that made her turn the mirror away, had begun to burn on her ribcage. The jagged shape a line of discomfort as it tore its way down her right leg. Trying not to think of the matching line of destruction on her true skin, the way it wouldn't heal. The terrible numbness that occurred when she tried to pull it any higher than the bottom of her ribcage. Elsewhere in the city, a hag stewing above her cauldron shivered despite the warmth of the fire. Elsewhere in the city, a fairy shuddered in his sleep, old pain flaring. Elsewhere in the city, a wizard felt an unpleasantly familiar ache, like a spinal tap of medicine oozing over her neurons, taking a shocked, sober breath. Elsewhere in the city, a gargoyle perched as eternally steadfast as the stones shifted in discomfort. Unbeknownst to them, a powerful spell washed against the shores of North America. A spell that spread across the continent, searching, halted only by the dark depths of the sea. Salt water is said to break magic. The cyan fires of the merfolk and the deep songs of the slumbering ones were proof enough against that. A wizard may be thwarted by the power of fathoms, but for others there were cracks, technicalities, finger holds, however narrow. Somewhere far, but not too far away, the last breath of an incantation left a pair of crooked lips and they smiled. Blood of an enemy, identified. Not the prey sought, but auspicious nonetheless. Feferi. By the time Eridan woke up and stumbled into the kitchen, his feathers sticking every which way, the room was clean and orderly, the dishes all drying, the utensils put away. Feferi had a pot of coffee brewing and was making herself something simple, not in the mood to get fancy. Two eggs sizzled in the pan, and the toast was warm, the two pieces each sporting a large slice of tomato. Her tears were long gone, washed down the drain with all the suds. She wasn't going to tell him, she'd already decided that. Nobody needed to hear her blubbering when there were more important things to worry about, like their friend's survival. "Morning, Fef. There's one of those for me," Eridan asked, shuffling over to the coffee pot and eyeing her eggs hungrily. She rolled her eyes. Snatching up her plate of toast, she slid the eggs off the pan and watched them land on their respective target. "Nope, this is for me. Make your own, I'm going to sit and enjoy mine." "Oh, thanks." Grinning, she plucked the coffee cup from Eridan's lax grip, then absconded to the table with her stolen prize. The siren squawked in the protest and she giggled. He would just have to pour himself a new one. After sitting down at the table, she surreptitiously pulled up her skirt, peeking at the bottom of the scar. It was still feeling weird, some sort of side effect of the accidental magic. The scar ended partway down her thigh, curving inward just above the spot where shorts wouldn't cover it. After 3 years, it hadn't faded, but it was fully healed. Right now, however, it looked fresh, a little scabby even, like her false skin might split. She quickly shoved the skirt back down to cover her knees, heart pounding. Whatever had happened, she just had to hope the effects would wear off soon. She hurriedly began eating one of the open-faced sandwiches, acting as if nothing was amiss as Eridan approached the table with a new cup of coffee and a plate of his own. His eggs looked a little burnt, and he was eyeing her pristine second egg on its golden toast with envy. She scooted the plate a little closer, and he pulled his face into a pout for a moment. "Fucking uncharitable," he griped at her, shifting his wings to express his displeasure as he sat down across the table. Feferi shrugged and kept chewing, struggling with the overly large bite she'd hastily taken. The siren, meanwhile, began to pick at his own eggs, cutting the burnt edges off with the side of his fork. As he did so, he pulled out his phone, typing in the code one-handedly and scrolling through his notifications, looking down through his thick, dark lashes. Feferi swallowed her mouthful, washing it down with black coffee. She'd forgotten that she'd stolen his rather than prepare one herself. She cleared her throat, getting his attention. "Any updates?" she inquired, gesturing at the phone with what was left of the toast. His brow furrowed in confusion, so she added, "About Vriska, I mean." "Oh, no. Nothing to report on that front. However, he said, pausing dramatically. I did find out who this Dave character is. The one that's supposed to be telling Khan about Vriss's condition. I mean, we've heard of him before. He's her archmate, kinda. The guy who introduced her to a girlfriend. He waved his fork around, a piece of burnt egg still stuck to it as he spoke. But as it turns out, we've already met him. He puffed out his chest and smugly finished. I saved his life on Thursday. Feferi's brows shot up in surprise as she remembered the incident. The weirdo wearing sunglasses on a cloudy day and hanging out on a roof. How Eridan had swooped down out of the sky and prevented him from becoming a bloody smear on the concrete. Seriously? That guy was the Houston Hunter's son? She asked incredulously, trying and failing to imagine the rather mundane teenager facing off against an angry alternative. He got startled by Eridan for crying out loud, and sirens aren't even that scary. She took a sip of the coffee, wishing she'd grabbed the sugar. Oh, his brother, but yeah, same dude. Which means he owes me. Eridan said so with great emphasis and wiggled his brows. Maybe I can get him to buy me a drink for being so magnanimous and all that? Feferi choked and spluttered. Coffee nearly going down her windpipe. He wanted to go on a date with a human? What, you don't think I have a chance? He looked put down by her reaction, which surprised her a little. How was she supposed to know he was seriously considering it? I mean, he did call you a brainless, feathery asshole. Feferi said slowly, trying to figure out how to phrase this. Do you really think? He cut her off, all bravado and unfounded confidence. Trust me. That's all I know he was into me. Already thinking about my arse. He wiggled his eyebrows again. And I'm thinking we go visit Vriss. You cheer up while I make my move. He takes me out. Then I finally get some action around here. He grinned, and Feferi's brain simply failed, shorting out completely. He was serious. But he's human. I thought you didn't consider them worthy matches, she said, curious. Had his views finally changed? She supposed the young man had been attractive, his limbs long and tanned, with bleach blonde hair. Before he'd put those silly hipster shades on, Feferi had caught a glimpse of thick, dark lashes over almond-shaped eyes of a warm, light brown that was almost closer to red. His lips had been full, but she couldn't imagine Eridan kissing him, no matter how handsome he was. I thought you were about that. He waved his hands dismissively. I'll just get Vriss to turn him into a vampire. Oh, okay, not suddenly stopping his human phobia, just totally off his rocker. Eridan, that takes like a month. She can't just bite him like Karkat shitty Twilight books, she reminded him, trying not to think of him holding a struggling Dave down over Vriska's sickbed. Besides, she's in no condition. He cut her off again. But she lives in his house right now. And will for the foreseeable future. We've got plenty of time to strand it out with her, just like our war games. And with that ominous statement, he swiped Feferi's nasty, awful coffee and drained it down in one loud, obnoxious slurp. Dave. Dave would never eat another piece of cake so long as he lived. This was the first thought that drifted over his consciousness as he woke up on John's couch. John's dad had come home from whatever business enthusiast meeting he'd gone to and was so repulsively ecstatic that his son was baking that he had, in excitement, made and fed them all at least 3 whole cakes. After that, the 3 of them just spent the rest of the night hanging out. It was almost just like the days on Skype. John was right. It had felt like a bunch of old soldiers swapping war stories, sharing scars. He still managed to finish the translation. Some of the notes were smeared with frosting, but it was all legible, if not parsable. The translation, much like every other piece of Argum, was a whole lot of phonetic sounds that were probably just a bunch of names. Unfortunately for him, and fortunately for Rose, there were some portions that seemed to translate into whack instructions, and other portions that sounded uncomfortably purposeful. References to bonds across distances, a dearest person, and communication. Among the instructions were seashells. Ambergris, something called magnetic chalk? That last one was a bitch to translate. All of this abnormal translation required extensive use of the blood-stained notebook, which didn't encourage him all too much. Dave smacked his lips. His mouth felt fuzzy with dehydration and hydrogenated oils. He got up and walked over to the sink for a glass of water, seeing Rose still passed out in the recliner. She was given a few blankets, but it looked like she'd managed to kick all but one off. The survivor was twisted and snaked around her limbs, a corner of it resting over the lower half of her face. The water was deliciously cool and absent of corn syrup as it washed down his throat. It made the rest of him feel sticky and rumpled by comparison. Shit, he thought. Didn't get any of my clothes out of my room. No problem if John's dad was still asleep. An injured teenage girl ought to be as well. He'd just be really quick. The door to the apartment opened easily. Thankfully, he'd brought his key with him when leaving for Aradia's the previous day. He heard Bro snoring from the futon. His brother kept a majorly nocturnal schedule, and being called for the midday medical procedure took a lot out of his regular sleep pattern. Dave resolved to move more silently than usual as he crossed the apartment to his room. Once he opened the door and it shut with a quiet click, he let out a breath. Safe in his room, his sanctum, his wide-eyed, fanged, gaunt girl half-laying, half-crouched defensively on his bed. All right, the vampire. Dave's back was to the door. The room was dark, the curtains drawn. What was the way out of this one?
What's up?
He whispered casually.
Vriska, yeah?
Are you Dave? She croaked at him. You look like the hunter. You look like a Dave, too. What the fuck was that supposed to mean?
The fuck is that supposed to mean? Dave whispered back.
The girl's eyes were already darting all around him. How he was positioned in the room, how his weight was balanced on his feet. That was a play to give her time to think he recognized. No way she didn't know what he looked like if Kanaya shared any pictures with her internet friends.
You know what? Dave started. Never mind. Yeah, I'm Dave, Kanaya's friend. Could you just, like...
He made a lowering motion with his hands.
Stop looking like you're about to jump out the fucking window. We're on the 5 billionth floor and... Your entire body's covered in stitches and a splint. Fuck, are those staples?
The girl sat back down and pulled his blanket up over her chest, like he'd walked in on her naked. She wasn't. She was wearing incredibly stylish black and silver pajamas that had to have come from Kanaya. All right, if you're not a threat, what are you doing in here? She hissed.
This is my room. My bro's keeping you here to keep an eye on you. I just need some clothes that aren't covered in fucking cake frosting and pie filling.
He was exaggerating, of course, but it felt like he had cake mix in places cake mix ought never to be. He started slowly moving over to his closet. Vriska sniffed the air. Apparently, she'd accepted his presence, at least for now. Dave turned to grab something clean from the rack. It was a little difficult to find something matching in the dark like this. He was digging for socks when Vriska spoke up from behind him. I've never had cake before, she said, half to herself. Dave had to pause to let the sadness of the statement register in his mind.
Well, that's one of the saddest fucking things I've ever heard, he said as he finally found the matching sock to the one he was holding.
Fuck you, she said casually, like she sincerely didn't care what he thought. Pretty cool, he guessed. The fan in the corner of the room pushed a waft of humid air past Dave.
All right, I can get you a piece of cake with a couple conditions, he said.
Vriska raised an eyebrow at him.
Just two. Don't fuck with my shit while you're staying in here and explain to me why a vampire wants cake. Thought you bitches just drank blood exclusively.
She sneered at him. Born vampires need to eat for the same reason everything else has to eat, smartass. Blood doesn't have every single vitamin a body needs to turn into an adult. Once we hit full adulthood, though, we don't have to eat anymore unless we want to, she said.
Oh, word. Guess that explains...
He gestured at his neck. No holes. She was looking at him with a stare that suddenly seemed hungry and not for cake.
Cool, you like chocolate,
he said. Her eyes lit up. The cake is chocolate? She asked, a little too loudly. Dave winced.
Yeah,
he whispered, trying to convey the volume to her.
Just don't wake bro up while I'm gone.
She nodded eagerly. Dave returned to the Egbert apartment with an empty plate. He'd snuck the cake up to Vriska, and she fit the whole damn thing in her mouth and basically swallowed it whole. It was a big fucking slice, too. He wondered if that was a vampire thing or a Vriska thing. Rose was up and stretching. He must have woken her up, banging around in the fridge and looking for utensils. Good morning, Dave, she said. She looked at the plate. He was walking over to the sink. Have you eaten more cake? I'm nauseous at the very notion, she asked. Now Vriska wanted a slice. Apparently vampires eat, he said. Oh, Rose said. Is she all right, then? Dave shook his head. I saw a splint in Staples. I don't know how the fuck vampires work, but it looks like she needs to be in the hospital. Bro mentioned a manhunt, vamp hunt, or some shit. Guess that's why she's in my bed. Rose made a noncommittal noise and went to get her own glass of water. Dave waited for her to start sipping it. By the way, Kanai messaged me about you yesterday, he said. Rose spatted a sitcom spray and started coughing. Beautiful, John would be proud. He laughed while she wiped her mouth off over the sink. You dickhead, are you serious? She asked. Yeah, she says she was sorry about some of the shit she said yesterday and wanted to talk. I figured you needed at least a night's sleep to cool off before you dove right back into the shit heap. Rose started moving back and forth in the kitchen, frantically unsure what to do. I need to go get ready. I mean, shit, she said. She started gathering all of her stuff, phone included, which she immediately started typing on. Tell John thank you for hosting, thank you for telling me, and thank you for, well, everything. I'll talk to you later was cut off by the apartment door closing. Women. Dave shook his head. She even forgot the whalebone.
For the full text of this and other stories by the same authors, visit the AO3 pages of Madam Melon Meow and Sarcastic Celery. Constant Conquest by Michael Guy Bowman. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information on my website, which is located at sangabrielvo.com. And there you can learn about other stories that I've read, my Discord server, and ways to support what I do. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.